You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You can probably treat yourself to an ad-free upgrade, or at least grab an extra latte. After getting a Chime checking account with features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe, no minimum balance requirements, and no monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/goals24. That's chime.com/goals24. Chime. Feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Stephen A. Schwartzman is the entrepreneur who took $400,000 in 1985 and co-founded Blackstone, the investment firm that today manages over $500 billion. He's a CEO whose views are sought by heads of state. He's the billionaire philanthropist who founded Schwartzman Scholars, this century's version of the Rhodes Scholarship in China. But behind these achievements is a man who has spent his life learning and reflecting on what it takes to achieve excellence, make an impact, and live a life of consequence. From deal-making to investing, leadership to entrepreneurship, philanthropy to diplomacy, Schwartzman has lessons for how to think about ambition and scale, risk and opportunities, and how to achieve success through the relentless pursuit of excellence. He's distilled them into a new book titled What It Takes. And today, Stephen joins me on the podcast to talk about his humble middle-class beginnings as the son of a linen salesman in Philadelphia, his undergrad years at Yale rooming with a literal Nazi, and his own version of summer at sea working on a Scandinavian shipping boat. He reveals how a famous statesman convinced him to go into business instead of politics, and how he landed his first job in finance that he was completely unqualified for. He recalls his struggles to raise investors for Blackstone and how he capitalized the fund in 1987, just days before Black Monday, the biggest stock market tumble since the Great Depression. He shares how an early loss completely changed how Blackstone evaluates risk, why the firm jumped into real estate at a time when no one was buying or selling, and how the company weathered the 2008 financial crisis. He also talks about his friendship with President Donald Trump, his efforts to back-channel trade negotiations between the U.S. and China, and why the Chinese know him by the name Farmer Blackstone. Coming up with Stephen Schwartzman in just a moment. Stephen A. Schwartzman is chairman, CEO, and co-founder of Blackstone, one of the world's leading investment firms. Mr. Schwartzman is an active philanthropist with a history of supporting education, culture, and the arts, among other areas. He also served as chairman of President Trump's Strategic and Policy Forum, and he's played an active role in U.S. trade negotiations with Canada, Mexico, and China. Now he writes about his adventures in business, politics, and philanthropy, along with some valuable tips for success in his new book, What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Well, Stephen, I enjoyed the book very much, and you actually start the book by talking about your middle-class childhood in Philadelphia. Your dad had a successful linen business, and early on you recall trying to convince him to expand and open other locations, but he wasn't interested in thinking big. I guess he just didn't have that entrepreneurial gene, did he? So I wonder, where did yours come from?
Well, I think it came from my mother. My dad was super smart and a lovely person, and, you know, I loved him very much. He wasn't aggressive, which has some positive elements to it. My mother, on the other hand, would have been the CEO of a major company today if in her day women had access to those kinds of positions. And I got the right mix of genes from her as well as from my dad.
Well, after that, you end up going to Yale for undergrad. And in one of the more amusing parts of this book, you recall getting paired with a college roommate who was an actual Nazi. I'm talking, had Nazi memorabilia, Nazi flag, and I think you said he even went to bed every night listening to Nazi military marches. Did he not realize that you were Jewish, or did he just not care? And how did you put up with that?
When I went to college, I went to Yale. They had like 4,000 undergraduates, and I didn't know any of them when I got there. They had 8,000 total students, another 4,000 graduate students. I didn't know any of them. I didn't know one professor, and I didn't know anybody in the administration. So I was like a pretty isolated, free-floating molecule. And I just took everything that was there for what it was. I didn't have any frame of reference. I never went away anyplace. So I thought it was really odd, but maybe that was part of the college experience. It was quite strange.
And I forget whether this was during your time at Yale or when you were getting your MBA at Wharton, but at a certain point, you also decided to take a summer at sea. Now, your version of a summer at sea is not what most kids think of today. You took some pretty rough jobs on several Scandinavian tanker and freight vessels. I can't imagine anything further from an Ivy League college setting. What was that like?
Well, that was fun. That was fascinating. And I tried to get a job in the American Seamen's Union, and apparently, unless you were connected, you couldn't get that, and they recommended I go over to the Scandinavian Seamen's Union, and they didn't pay much, but they had jobs, and I got one. Interestingly, on a freighter, it was, and the place it was going was listed as destination unknown, which appealed to sort of my sense of adventure. And I said, how did they do this destination unknown thing? They said, well, on a tanker, they don't know when you're going to be buying a cargo, and they buy it at the last minute, and the ship goes where it needs to pick up the cargo. So if you're in New York and your destination unknown, you go under the bridge. If you go straight, you're going to Europe. If you turn left, you're going to Canada. If you turn right, you're going to the Caribbean. And the boat turned right, and we went to Trinidad Tobago to pick up a cargo. I was a wiper, so I worked in the engine room, which is about 110 to 120 degrees, and deafening with an engine going all the way, powering the boat. And my job was just to wipe down grease. So I must say, this was a little different than my first year at college. When we got back from that, I switched and got on a Danish freighter, which was much better. I became a second cook. I woke up at 4 in the morning making bread and then cooked for the crew breakfast. And that was really lovely. And we went down to Colombia in South America and hit all the ports there. It was amazing. It was an adventure every night. The sunsets were astonishing. And I brought all the works of Sigmund Freud with me to read. Huh. So I guess I wasn't the typical seaman.
Yeah.
but it was quite fascinating.
Yeah, I have to think after seeing the world, it was probably hard to go back to school.
Well, it was terrible. And I remember getting back to school, and in the school newspaper, on the front page, they said, if you're feeling depressed, you should go see the university psychiatrist. So I was totally depressed. It was such a big adventure. Why was I back in New Haven? It was gray and wasn't too interesting. So I went and saw this fellow, and, you know, he was wearing, he looked like Central Casting. I mean, he had a little beard and, you know, a pipe. And, you know, the white coat. And he said, young man, what's your problem? And I said, I'm really sort of a little unhappy to be back here. And I started talking about all these adventures, and you could see the guy's eyes bugging out. And he said, of course you're depressed to be back. I can put you in group therapy. But he said, I don't think that's going to do anything for you. I said, why would I want to be a group of depressed people? That doesn't seem to work for me. He said, well, listen, just wait a month or two, and you'll forget about where you were, and you could just be a normal student again.
Yeah.
And goodbye. And that's what worked out.
Given all your reading on the boat, was he a Freudian or a Jungian?
He was a Freudian.
Okay. And I was surprised to learn that you originally wanted to go into public service, even to the extent that you worked your connection through Yale's Skull and Bone Society to secure a meeting with Avril Harriman. What did he say to change your mind about politics?
Well, the first question, he was a very eminent person.
Right.
And previously governor of New York and a whole variety of other postings, including being the ambassador to the Soviet Union during World War II for the United States. And before that, he had graduated from Yale, and his father was one of the richest people in the world who basically created the Union Pacific Railroad. And so I sat down, he invited me to his house, and he said, young man, are you independently wealthy? I almost thought it was a joke. I said, no, I'm not. And he said, well, that will make a great deal of difference in your life. And you wouldn't be sitting here talking to me if I wasn't the son of the chairman of the Union Pacific Railroad. He said, if you're not independently wealthy and you have an interest in politics, you shouldn't go into politics. You should try and make as much money as you could so that you can be independent yourself, not be dependent upon anybody who gives you money if you're going to be in politics. I listened to him, and I ended up going into business.
Yeah, and tell us about your first interview.
I had a number of odd experiences. The first time I interviewed at a firm no longer exists called Bankers Trust with the vice chairman of the organization, and he offered me a job at the end of a few hours of spending time with him, and then he told me not to take it. And I said, why shouldn't I take it? He said, I think you'll be bored here. He said, well, you should be with a small group of very smart people doing almost anything. Mm-hmm. So with that as a guide, I ended up having an interview with the CEO of a firm called Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenneret, which was a relatively small but very visible brokerage and money management firm. And I met the CEO, and having waited in their waiting room, reception area, with all these young people working there, both men and women, very energetic and attractive. And I walked into the CEO's office, Bill Donaldson, and he said, why do you want to work at DLJ? And I said, I don't even know what DLJ does, but with these attractive people who are working here, excited, alive, they all look, jazzed up and intelligent. Whatever you're doing, I want to do it. So he laughed and had me interview with his partners. I had no training. I never took an economics course. I still haven't. And I didn't know anything about accounting. And I interviewed with all these people, and I went back to the CEO's office, and he said, how did your day go? I said, from whose perspective? he said, any way you want to describe it. And I said, well, I said, I think all your partners think you're nuts having me talk to them because I have no capability. I'm just wasting their time. So he started laughing, and he said, look, I'll give you a call in a few days. And he offered me a job, and it was $10,000, which was a lot of money in those days, particularly for someone who is not competent. And I said, you know, that's really terrific, but I need $10,500. And he said, what do you mean? I said, I need $10,500 because I want to be the best compensated person in my class at college who gets a job. So he said something sensible like, well, that's of no concern to me. The job is $10,000 and you're not worth $10,000. And I said, okay, I really want the $10,500. And he said, I don't care. And I said, well, I care. And it's not much money for you. He called me about 2 days later. He said, okay, $10,500.
And your exit interview was almost more interesting than your initial interview. What did he say to you then?
At the end of 7 months there, I was called into the Army. And I was leaving, and I had an exit interview with him. And I said, Bill, why did you ever hire me? I had no capability. And he said, I had a sixth sense that someday you're going to be the head of my firm. That was 1969. Wow. In 1982, one of the other three founders, Dick Jenneret, who was the only one that was still in the business, called me up for a meeting and asked me to come over, and he asked me to be the president of the firm. And I turned it down.
Yeah.
Because I said I wasn't capable. I was too young. I didn't have enough experience in managing people. And he said, no, you'll be terrific. And I said, no, I won't. I'm not ready. And, I let that one go.
Yeah. You must have wondered what happened to the confident kid who came in and asked for $10,500.
Well, you know, what happens as you get older, you actually get smarter.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain age where you think you're really amazing. I think it's somewhere in between 32 and 34 years old. And you think you're absolutely wonderful. As you get older than that, you realize you've got a lot of fall shorts.
Yeah.
As a person, as a professional talent.
Yeah.
You may be able to do something wonderfully well, but there are a lot of things that you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so you become much more balanced and thoughtful and actually accurate about your own capabilities.
And you did become the head of your own firm, of course, after you spent some time at Lehman and rose to become managing director at age 31 and then head of global mergers and acquisitions. You and your former boss at Lehman, Pete Peterson, decided to open Blackstone. When you and Pete Peterson set about raising money for the fund, neither of you had any experience with LBOs, but then I suppose not a lot of people did back then in the 80s. How did you persuade investors to take a chance on Blackstone?
Well, we thought it was no problem because both Pete and I had done a lot of stuff in both finance and non-financial worlds that worked out. And so we didn't understand why people wouldn't bet on us. Only an inexperienced entrepreneur would believe what I just said. That people who have money actually like to give it to people who know what they're doing in that specific area. And, I had worked with other groups as an advisor to them when they were buying things. So I had a pretty good idea of what was going on in that private equity world. But I just hadn't been the owner. I had advised people who were owners. And I thought that was readily transferable. And we just had a miserable time. We started out sending out about 500 offering circulars. We only got two people, two companies that agreed to give us any money. It was horrible because if we could get meetings at all, people would turn us down. And we were about ready to fail. And we just kept going. That's one of the lessons in life. If you think you have a good product, a good situation, and the world isn't buying it, you try and change it a little bit, but you just keep going. And we went to an organization called the Prudential Insurance Company, which was the largest insurance company in the world at that time. Chief Investment Officer was there having lunch with us, which was a real compliment. And he was eating a tuna sandwich on white bread cut on a diagonal. You know, I was doing the same pitch where I mostly failed everywhere else. And he finished the first half of his sandwich. And then he started eating the other half. And he had a big Adam's apple. And I kept watching his Adam's apple go up and down like a metronome. He was halfway through the second part of his sandwich. And he looked at me and he said, "That's a really interesting idea you have. I'll give you $100 million. I said, "$100 million? And he said, "Yes, $100 million. And the only thing I could think of was, I can't let this guy choke on the other half of a sandwich. And because they were the number one investor in the world in this asset class, I knew that if we got their commitment, that we would somehow, based on their reputation, not ours, be able to raise the rest of the money. And we raised $850 million, which made us still the third biggest fund in the world and the biggest first-time fund. And it was all because of that one commitment. It was really a close call. The difference in life between success and failure is a lot thinner than most people would think.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Stephen Schwartzman when we come back in just a minute. Nobody goes into business because they want to collect sales tax for the government, but it's something that all businesses need to do. Thankfully, Avalara takes the mystery and pain out of the complex process of managing sales tax. Avalara uses the power of the internet and cloud services to automate the tax compliance process for businesses of all sizes, integrating directly with the accounting, e-commerce, point-of-sale, and marketplace platforms that you're already using. Avalara software automatically calculates the right amount of tax that should be charged for every product in every situation, in real time, and files your sales tax returns whenever and wherever they're due. Selling internationally adds a whole new level of complexity, but Avalara has experts in 15 countries around the world to help you navigate compliance challenges as you grow. I've run my own business for 20 years now, and I've got enough on my plate without having to worry about taxes. It's a headache, and sales taxes are especially tricky with different regulations across various states and countries. So stop spending valuable time worrying about your sales tax returns and focus on the things you actually love about running your business. Go to avalara.com/kick to learn more about how Avalara can help you. That's Avalara, AVALARA.com/kick. Avalara, tax compliance done right. You guys locked up that $850 million in investor capital on October 15th, 1987, a Thursday. The very next Monday is Black Monday, biggest market drop in U.S. history. Do you ever think about what might have happened if you guys had just waited a few more days?
Does the word continually have meaning to you? We got the final documents in from some of the investors on Friday, and then the world completely collapsed on Monday. And I usually have like a sixth sense when something bad is about to happen. And I was just almost frantic to get this thing closed. And we had at that point only one employee, who was a lovely woman who previously worked at Goldman Sachs. And because I had nothing else to do, I would like walk in her office every 10 minutes to see how we were doing with all these closing documents. I'm sure I was exceptionally annoying. And after the fund closed, she left our firm and became a psychoanalyst. So I don't know what that says, but it was, the beginnings of almost every organization are extremely difficult and with outcomes that are really unpredictable. And you go into them thinking that you know how it's going to turn out. And you have a certain confidence based on something in your past and what you believe your objectives are, and it doesn't always happen that way, and you have to make it happen, or else it'll collapse. And you know, we were very lucky to round up the other money, but also to close it. You know, ultimately the day before the biggest stock market decline since the Depression.
Yeah, timing is everything. And one of the most important rules in your book is never lose money. Now, that seems kind of obvious, but I guess it's easier said than done. Blackstone's third investment in a company, I believe it was called Edgecomb, lost money for your investors, but it ends up being a transformative moment for Blackstone. How did that change the company?
Well, it changed it enormously. One of the things that most people don't think about is how you learn in a new setting. And most people think being successful is the most important thing. Actually, if you're successful at things at the beginning and you really don't have a major mistake, you don't learn much from being successful. It's you're doing something that's completely within your comfort zone. When you fail, most people try not to think about it because it's painful and it's embarrassing. On the other hand, I've always found that analyzing your failures and coming up with the rules so you learn from that failure, so you make changes so you can never fail again in that way. And Edgecomb was a point of a case like that. And what we did is completely change the approach to approving investments to a committee process instead of relying on me as a person, that everything had to be in writing, that all the major risks had to be evaluated and put down for people to assess, and that at the committee itself, every person had to participate and reflect on those risks and put any other risks that they saw on the table for evaluation as well. And so the concept of not having one great person, man or woman, who's in charge doing interrogation of the group that brings a proposal, with everybody else being in effect a paid audience to watch that interrogation, we broke that down and forced everybody to participate, because the more people you have who are very bright and focused, the better outcome you'll get. And then we would send the team that brought the potential investment back to answer the questions from that group. They'd have to put those answers in writing. They then come back again. The process continues, and maybe they go back a third time. And by the time you finish all that, you know what those risks are. You've had vigorous debate as to the probability that those risks would occur, and if they did, how bad it would be for the company. And if we felt that the probability was high enough and the risks overall were a bit too high that we were going to lose capital, we just didn't do it. And we still are using that system, which has worked amazingly well for us.
Yeah, and you've been accused at times of being risk-averse. Do you find it curious that some people say risk-averse as if it's a bad thing?
I've learned since I've been doing this financial stuff for 5 decades. Hard to imagine. I still think I'm 38, let alone, you know, sort of this going on. I've learned that there are no brave old people in finance. And usually they get picked off in their 30s or 40s. And, you know, taking risk is sort of the stuff you think if you watch a movie or, you know, hear somebody's interview that, you know, people who start things and do things are very squashbuckling characters who go where nobody else sensible would do. And,
right,
you know, they won the game because they're so brilliant. And that's not the way it actually works. Most entrepreneurs are pretty conservative. They think through things pretty carefully before they do them. and they only want them to work. And so this idea of being out there taking risk and, you know, sort of being, you know, sort of exceptionally brave, you don't care about the consequences, there actually aren't that many people like that.
Well, today, Blackstone has the largest portfolio of real estate holdings in the world, and I want to talk about what led you to make that leap into that sector. When you got in, the real estate market was stagnating. No one was buying and no one was selling in the early 90s. What did you see that no one else was seeing? Or maybe some people were seeing, but they just weren't acting.
Yeah, that's a good question. Somebody brought us a potential transaction who at that point was a consultant for what was called the RTC, the Resolution Trust Company, that was set up by the U.S. government around 1990 to take on board the assets of failed savings and loan companies because real estate had collapsed. And the government started trying to sell some of those assets, and there were hardly any takers, in large part because the people who owned real estate were fighting with their banks because they couldn't pay their principal and interest. And so everyone was going through awful conversations. We didn't own any real estate. So I just looked at this first thing we were trying to buy, which was an auction, a second auction from the RTC. And it had a bunch of garden apartments in Little Rock, Arkansas, in East Texas. I'd never been to East Texas. I'd never been to Little Rock, Arkansas. And I realized these apartments were 80% filled and pretty new. I looked at it and it had a certain amount of cash flow coming off of those properties, but not enough to stop them from defaulting on their principal and interest. And I said, well, where would I like to pay for it so that I got a good yield? So I just set a price at 6x cash flow, which was roughly 16, 17% yield with no debt on it. And that's what we bid, and we won. And the reason I did that is if you put some mortgages, in effect, borrowed money on top of that portfolio, you could turn 16% a year into 23% a year, which was really very good considering you didn't have to have anything favorable happen. But if the economy recovered, which I was pretty sure it would, that 23% would end up as 45% when you rented those other empty apartments. And further, I thought that rents would go up when the economy went up, and that would take the 45% return to 55%. So I thought we were going to be buying a 55% annual return. As it turned out, it was a 62% annual return. But once I did the first one, and I saw what would happen, there was almost no risk to these things, because you could price them the way you wanted to, because you were almost the only firm buying, and so we just kept buying, and it's been a remarkable run in our real estate business.
Yeah, I should say so. I might be wrong, but I want to say that real estate makes up the majority of your business now.
It's about half.
Okay.
Another quarter is in private equity. And then we have the balance split with our credit business and our hedge fund area.
Well, your life has sort of come full circle by now from that early meeting with Avril Harriman, because over the last few years, Stephen, you've been spending a lot more time in Washington. You chaired President Trump's Strategic and Policy Forum, and you've been involved in U.S. trade negotiations. You've also known Donald Trump for a long time, and you actually say in here that you routinely field calls from people who ask you to help them understand the president. What do you say to them? How do you explain Trump?
Well, that's not the world's easiest job, that was particularly right after he was elected, because other than watching him on television, foreign governments and companies outside the United States had no idea he was and how they might interact with him. And they basically didn't have a lot of people that they knew to call. And so it was an interesting time period. You never know how your life's going to evolve. I was chairman of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, which is part of that was because at Yale, somebody 1 year older than me became president, George W. Bush. It's just the luck of life in a way. You know, I didn't know I was going to be in college with somebody who was going to be president. And I met his dad, who also became president. So a lot of these things are unplanned, sort of Forrest Gump kind of situations.
Yeah.
And that takes you somewhere else.
Yeah, and who would have thought that you would be helping to negotiate trade with China? I mean, you've had a relationship there for many years. I want to say that Blackstone was the first investment by China's sovereign wealth fund a few years back. And one of the people who actually sought your advice on Trump was Chinese President Xi Jinping. In the book, you recall meeting with him during the World Economic Forum and explaining Trump's perspective on trade and copyright infringement. He then told you that he was open to an economic reset with the U.S. My question is, what happened?
Well, it's complicated to do that. China has internal politics as well as the U.S. has internal politics. And in China's case, they have hardliners, if you will, who think they're doing just fine with their current system. And then they have what are called reformers who realize that given China's scale, that the mechanisms that it used as a developing country, you know, sort of with high tariffs and taxes that make it tough for people to sell into their country with relatively closed markets compared to the developed world, with not well-developed intellectual property protections and a whole variety of other things, that works when you're a smaller developing economy. But when you become second biggest in the world, things change. And it would be normal for China not want to change because, you know, they've been growing at least three times as fast as the United States over the last 40 years. And it's been an economic miracle for them. They started 40 years ago with GDP per capita of about a few hundred dollars, and now it's $10,000 a person. That's a huge increase, and it's going up now at the rate of $1,000 a year. And so, you know, the question is why change? And you know, the reason to change is that the imbalances financially that grow up need to be addressed. And, you know, the current government in the United States is trying to have China come to the table with proposals that get closer to balance with the developed world. And we'll see how that comes out. There are meetings all day today in Washington with Vice Premier Liu He representing China and Ambassador Bob Lighthizer, our trade representative and Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin. And, you know, we'll all be reading about it in a few hours, probably, and we'll see where we go. Over time, there should be adjustments, and I believe there will be. The question is, how fast will that happen? What will be the magnitude and the timing of those changes? It will reveal itself better today, so it's harder for me to comment and, you know, right this second.
Well, I mentioned that you've been doing business in China for years, and over there you're known as Farmer Blackstone, right? How did you get that nickname?
Well, that was pretty funny. The Chinese government bought into our IPO in 2007 for Blackstone. That was the second biggest IPO of the decade. The largest one was Google. And so we were quite well known. And about a year after they bought in, the global financial crisis happened. And the average financial stock, people forget this, during the financial crisis, went down 85%. Blackstone was an outperformer. We went down 90%. So if you've ever lived through something like that, it's pretty unappealing, particularly if you were the person who lost the 90%. You only lose it if you sell. The rest of it is just sort of a quote for what the current market believes the company is worth. And I think for the Chinese, this was very difficult because nobody likes to give the appearance of losing money. And I would meet once a year with the former premier of the country who started the leading business school in China. Premier Zhu Rongji would sort of kid me about losing China's money. He said, "Oh, you still lose money for China." And I said, "Actually, we are not losing money. We are buying wonderful companies that we will make even more wonderful and lead to great profits for all of our investors. But we are like farmers. And when we buy a company, it's like planting a seed. And you cannot see that crop when it's under the ground. But it will come out. When it comes out, it will grow very high, and there will be very big crops, and you will be very happy." So he started, sort of dragging me around the room, introducing me to everyone there who I knew anyhow as Farmer Blackstone, who was going to bring the big crop for China and the other shareholders. And now, in the fullness of time, it's 11 years, And Blackstone has basically gone up about 1.5 times the value of the Standard & Poor's average. So we've been a very good performer. But it certainly was tough in the middle of the financial crisis.
Well, Farmer Blackstone, I know you have to go. So real quickly, I just want to close by asking you about the last chapter of the book, 25 Rules for Work and Life. What's the most important rule in there?
Every rule is important or they wouldn't be there.
Okay.
There are all kinds of rules from doing something big as opposed to something modest if you're going to be starting or expanding what you do or a business or a non-for-profit where you're working. I've always found that to be successful requires an enormous effort. These things don't happen just because you want them to. And you always have setbacks. And if you're going to commit yourself 100 to 120% of your full capacity, if you're doing that, you can't do something else when it comes by. So if you start with something very modest, you could end up having to pass up much better things. And so a lot of the invention of new things comes from thinking and making sure you've got something that's unique, something wonderful, something the world will want or your customers will want. You basically succeed in that not by the implementation, which most people think is work and important. It's the vision and how big something can be and how wonderful it is, for the target market or the customer. And that's where you win the game. You then play it out by doing it and making sure you're doing something that's worthy of your time. Because once you commit, you can't commit to other things. It's just too hard to be successful. And so that's an interesting one of the 25 rules.
Great advice. Again, Stephen Schwartzman's book is called What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence. Stephen, thanks for talking with me.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Thanks again to Stephen Schwartzman for coming on the show. Order his new book, What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. When you own your own business, you have enough on your plate without having to worry about taxes. Stop wasting valuable time worrying about your sales tax returns and focus on the things you actually love about running your business with a little help from Avalara. Avalara simplifies sales tax compliance with real-time rates and automatic filing. Their software seamlessly integrates with the systems you're already using, so it couldn't be easier. Go to Avalara, AVALARA.com/kick to learn more. Avalara, sales compliance done right. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.